Good evening, I'm Jim Zirin. You're watching The Digital Age. Frank DeFord is with us tonight. Frank DeFord is a legendary sports writer. Yes, America, before there were bloggers, there were sports writers. Frank DeFord has been the featured writer for Sports Illustrated magazine. He is a television personality appearing on Morning Edition for NPR. He has written many books, including 10 novels, and his latest book is an absolute gem. It is Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer. You get the pun, Overtime, Overtime. In the book, he chronicles a 50-year, absolutely extraordinary career in which he interviewed some of the most iconic figures of our generation. We are delighted to have you with us, Frank DeFord.
Jim, thank you very much.
Congratulations on the book. It's really quite marvelous. And in the book, it appears you attempt to recapture the heyday of American sports writing. Whatever prompted you to try to do this?
I was encouraged by Terry McDonald, who's the editor of Sports Illustrated, and I think what prompted him was watching Mad Men on television, because advertising and magazines were sort of first cousins to each other, and he sort of wanted me to bring back that halcyon days of the 1960s when men hung out together and smoked and drank entirely too much and somehow managed to get out a magazine in the process.
Office Affairs, was it really like that? Was it like Mad Men?
It was. Sports Illustrated was not that way so much because we didn't have that many women around, or girls, as they were known then. And we were much more of an all-male operation. The office affairs were more. I'm not saying there weren't office affairs in Sports Illustrated, please, but I'm saying you would find more of that in the other parts of the hallowed halls of Time Incorporated.
Now, in the book, you say that sports writers are often deprecatingly referred to as scribes. Whatever made you want to be a sports writer?
I didn't want to be a sports writer. I wanted to be a writer.
You could have been the Walter Lippmann of our time, and then you became a sports writer.
I don't think I ever could have been a pundit, as they say. You remember that word,
pundit? You were a sports pundit.
But from the time I was a little boy, I was one of these people who knew what I wanted to be. As soon as I found out I could write, and I wanted to go to New York because that's where writers went, right? And I got the opportunity to go to Sports Illustrated, and I was very admiring of the magazine's work as a literary journal. We had a marvelous, marvelous editor, Jim. His name was André Laguerre. Unfortunately, he was not that well known during his lifetime. He was a Frenchman. He was a Frenchman who made Sports Illustrated, and by the way, also made the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Let's give him credit for that, too. He had been de Gaulle's press secretary during the war. He knew every writer that ever lived. And to work with him, I think, really made me understand that it was okay to be a sports writer. He said, Frankie, he's one of the few people who ever used the diminutive with me. Frankie said, it isn't what you write, it's simply how well you write about it. It's the craft, not the subject. And all of a sudden, I was a lifer.
A lifer, and you must feel as though you died and went to heaven. Did you play sports in high school?
Now, I'm glad you asked that question, because that allows me, after, 55 years, to relive the one great moment of my life. I had a fabulous senior year as a high school basketball.
You were hot.
I was hot. I got hot. I grew. I put on 20 pounds of muscle to become a lithe 155 pounds. And I could shoot. I couldn't do anything else, but I could shoot. And I could shoot over people.
Were you a banger under the basket?
Oh, no. I let other people do that. I just simply shot.
How were you from the free throw line?
I could shoot, Jim. I could make shots. Now, I couldn't do anything else. I was terribly, terribly slow. But we had a great playmaker, my best friend on the team, a guy named Alan Yarbrough, a wonderful athlete, and he would get me the ball and I would shoot. Now, water finds its own level. I got to college.
You went to Princeton.
I went to Princeton and I got to college.
So did you write or did you play at Princeton?
I wrote.
And play basketball.
Well, and the coach was a wonderful old guy named Cappy Capon. And Cappy worked a five-man weave. I won't go into that, but that's what he used long after everybody else had abandoned it. And Cappy came over to me one day and said in his old gruff, sweet manner, DeFord, you write basketball better than you play it. And I knew already that my athletic career had probably come to a grinding halt, but that was the final end of it.
So you were launched, and you became the chairman of the college paper, the Daily Princetonian. Yeah. So you had jurisdiction over sports and non-sports. But what caused you to go on into sports?
If there had not been a Sports Illustrated, I don't think I ever would have gone into sports. It was simply because there was that opportunity, and I was smart enough, dumb and arrogant as a kid as I was, I realized that I was better writing long-form journalism than the column, which was then, of course, the be-all and end-all of anybody in journalism, and I knew that I needed more space to bloviate, and Sports Illustrated gave me that opportunity. And what I found is sports allows you a lot more territory than just the scores, just the X's and O's, and the ability to write about fascinating people and all the human emotions, really, which are tucked into sports. People think of it as a very sort of narrow domestic area, but I've been in something like 35 or 40 countries writing about sports. It's been a much more expansive existence than one would think under the rubric of sports writer.
Now, in college, you started interviewing people, not necessarily sports people. You interviewed Jimmy Stewart came to the campus. There's a picture of you and Jimmy Stewart
in the
book. You interviewed Elvis Presley when he came back from the Army. I know that.
You know that because you're with him.
I was with you.
On a snowy day.
And so was that sort of a backdrop for the direction your career took?
Interviewing is an interesting phase of journalism, part of journalism, and I've always said, and not altogether facetiously, that interviewing is really no more than a high school date taken to a higher level. The more you can be casual and not so much interview but chat, the more I found that you can get out of people. I even find that true when I'm doing television for real sports, and there may be all sorts of cameras around, and it's hardly an intimate setting. But if you can sort of get the person to just concentrate on you almost in sort of a hypnotic way and forget what's around, then you can succeed in getting people to open up. Now, having said that, I'm also quick to say I'm not one of these good investigative reporters. I was never any good in saying, where did you put the money? I know you had it. I'm more of a, you know, a chatter than I am an interrogator.
Well, you were a discoverer, too. You're credited with having discovered Bobby Orr when he was a teenage hockey player. You're credited with having discovered Bill Bradley, whose illustrious career at Princeton followed ours.
Jim, there's a difference.
Tell about that.
There's a difference between discovering and stumbling on. And I think that's called right place at the right time. Bradley was a freshman when I was a senior, and then I went to Sports Illustrated, and in those days the NCAA would not allow freshmen to play on the varsity team. Now, how many people saw the Princeton freshman team play the likes of the Brown freshman team or the Colgate freshman team? Not very many.
Wasn't a big draw.
It was So I go to Sports Illustrated and tell them that the best sophomore in the country is at Princeton. And, of course, they laughed and said, you know, the old tiger. But they threw me a bone and allowed me to do a story on it, which was one of the first stories I did. Bradley becomes, you know, an even bigger hit than even I had imagined. And everybody says, this kid knows his stuff. He can really pick them. And it was just dumb luck. Orr was the same way.
Bobby Orr.
I wouldn't know a hockey puck from a badminton bird under most circumstances.
Oh, come on.
But
I know the difference.
In covering basketball, the Celtics always won. So I hung out with the Boston writers, and the Boston writers would tell me about this hockey phenom who was coming, who was owned by the Bruins. In those days, Canadian players were sort of handed over to the teams, you know, briefly after they'd been weaned away from their mother's breast. And, and Bobby Orr was coming. He was going to save us. And I went back and told everybody at Sports Illustrated about that. I went up to see Bobby Orr. He turned out to be the greatest defenseman of all time. And once again, DeFord. DeFord had spotted him. DeFord, and I knew absolutely nothing
about him. You're batting 1,000.
Batting 1,000, and I think I quit. I don't think I ever discovered anybody else, Jim.
Right. Well, okay, you're there at Sports Illustrated, and you're batting out these wonderful stories on a typewriter because there were no computers in those days. And somehow or other, you get involved with a Miller Lite commercial, and you become one of the Miller All-Stars.
That was fun.
Now, let's go to the tape and see what you did about it.
I've had to write some tough things about some tough guys. But there's one guy I can't write anything bad about. His unique brand of baseball has made him a living legend.
Billy Martin.
Billy Martin. Now, there it is. But there was not only Billy Martin. There was Rodney Dangerfield. There was Madden. There were...
They were all wonderful.
There was the girl weightlifter, Lori Bowen.
And Lee Merriweather, who's the doll. She was so-called beautiful. And everybody treated her absolutely like a gentleman. And Lee was wonderful. She most of her bits were with Mickey Spillane. And all of them were terrific, except for Rodney Dangerfield, who was a total jerk. And I think Rodney's problem was that he'd never been part of a team before. He didn't understand. And so we suffered him, but the rest of them were terrific. And they treated me pretty well. I must say, as someone who was a sports writer who had written things about them, I had a certain trepidation. But they accepted me into the group, and I had a lot of fun. Tastes great.
Less filling.
Thank you very much.
How many times did you have to say that?
I said it a lot because after I did that commercial with Martin and Marvelous Marv Throneberry, I was only in the group commercials. And I think the word spear carrier would apply to me under those circumstances. The wonderful guys, and it was a great experience. And I still see some of them occasionally.
Now let's move on and talk about Arthur Ashe. Arthur Ashe became a close friend of yours, didn't he?
I never really wanted to be buddies with athletes. That was not the idea, but I ended up close to some of them. You have to remember I was very young, and so these guys were my contemporaries that I was covering. One of the problems, Jim, with
we're being, talking the 70s now.
Yeah, the 70s, 60s and 70s. And one of the problems with being a sports writer is that as you grow older, you're leaving the most prominent people that you're covering behind because they all stay as children. But at that time, I was contemporary with these. And Arthur lived in New York. We just had an awful lot in common, notwithstanding the fact that he was black and I was white. And I happened to be working with him on a book on the year that he went to South Africa to break the color line, which is really a very important historical moment.
At that point, he had won Wimbledon, the only black man.
He had won the U.S. Open and US he won Open. The Australian.
So I mean, two Grand Slams. Only black man to win two Grand Slam events.
Yes. And there really haven't been any black players, hardly.
Just Yannick Noah, who
at all
won
since
one.
Then. Yannick yes. Noah, I'm sorry, that's right. And actually, Arthur found Yannick Noah on a subsequent trip to Africa, State Department Corps. He came across this kid in Cameroon and recommended him to the French Federation, and that was really the beginning of Yannick Noah's trip to the top. But
so Arthur goes to South Africa. You went with him.
I went with him, and actually lived together. We lived in a, because you couldn't, blacks could not live in hotels, we lived in a private house, and I lived in
Didn't that break some law at the time, a black and a white?
I think actually we probably were cohabitating illegally.
Yeah.
They did treat him very well. I mean, they did not want, the South African government did not want any trouble, and there was no trouble, but what happened was that the fact that there was no trouble, the fact that he was accepted not just by the many blacks and so-called coloreds, but by the whites, I think it sort of started the process. That by itself started the process which ended not that far in the future with a man who at that time was in Robben Island in jail, Nelson Mandela being president of the country. Arthur really, really turned the switch that eventually changed everything.
Destroyed apartheid. Isn't that wonderful? Now, you write in the book that some people assume that Ash was kind of a dull guy, sort of a Ralph Nader with a head racket. Isn't that a marvelous DeFordian turn of phrase? But he was really a good guy,
wasn't he? He was a fine guy. And we had a delightful time together. And I think part of that is not only was he identified with so many serious issues, but then, of course, he died so tragically.
Yes.
And so, but he was absolutely delightful, and everybody had fun with Arthur Ashe. He had a great sense of humor, a marvelous laugh, and I look back on him, particularly as the years pass by and the tragedy fades a little bit, I look back on him, you know, fondly with the good times that we had together. Wonderful, wonderful man, and like Billie Jean King, another tennis player, a very important cultural figure in sports history.
Well, Billie Jean King, of course, broke a different kind of barrier, the barrier for out-of-the-closet gays in the sports world.
More than that, I mean, she really advanced the cause of women in sports. This is the 40th anniversary of Title IX, which gave women equal rights in a lot of areas. Nobody really expected it, by the way, to affect sports. That was a surprise. That was something that nobody anticipated when Richard Nixon signed it into law. But Billie Jean predated Title IX. She was out there speaking up, saying girls should play games, and being an absolute hero or heroine for little girls, and she changed the way I think that people looked upon women in sports.
And it's all in a book you wrote with her.
And then I wrote a book with her as well, and that was at a very difficult time, because it was when she was outed as a lesbian, and it was she was really doing it because she needed the money for her defense fund, and it was, I think, probably the lowest part of Billie Jean's life. She's since rebounded magnificently. She's had a wonderful partner, Alana Kloss, for 20 or 25 years, and we even have dinner together every now and then. And Billie Jean's important. She played an important role in the women's movement, and she won the Presidential Medal of Freedom a couple of years ago when no one deserved it more.
Yeah. Let's move on to another figure whom you interviewed, Wilt Chamberlain, Wilt the Stilt. Now, he had marvelous numbers. He had 100 points in one game, and he slept with 20,000 women.
Yeah, that was his.
So tell about him.
Well,
he claimed he slept with 20,000 women.
He claimed he slept with it. Somebody worked it out. It would have been very difficult to have also slept and eaten and moved about. Wilt and I had a very interesting relationship in which we really didn't like each other when I was covering him. Had some unpleasant moments. He once threw me out of a locker room, or designated someone to throw me out of a locker room. And it was only after he retired and a mutual friend suggested that we get together and sort of make up. And we did. And I wrote an article about him and spent a lot of time with him. And then, Jim, as you mentioned, he made that ridiculous claim of the 20,000 women. You see, I think that was part of Wilt's mindset, which is always be numerically the best. Prove you're the best. You're the tallest. You score the most points. If that's not enough, you get the most rebounds. If that's not enough, you get the most assists. Whatever. You make the most money. That was very, very important to him, and so forth. And so he writes the book, and he claims that he slept with 20,000 women, thinking that this is going to, people are going to say, wow, what a guy. And instead, it made him at the least a figure of fun, and at the most a slut. You know, people were disgusted with it. And it was, he finally realized that he needed some sort of rehabilitation. And the last time I saw him, he asked if I would help get a documentary made for HBO. I said, absolutely. And then within weeks, he was dead. And The only thing I can say about Will, as sort of the codicil to the Will, is that he was happier in the year, and the only athlete I know, the only great athlete I know, he was happier in the years after his career was over. So much was expected of him, and he could sort of never live up to those expectations. But I got to like Wilt, and I think he got to like me as well.
He had a major rivalry going with Bill Russell, yes, whom you also knew. Who was the better player?
Well, see, this is just it. The world was divided as much as it was into capitalism and communism, into the Russell camp and the Chamberlain camp. Anybody who cared about basketball, and I was a Russell man, and I don't think you can compare the two because they did different things. There's no question in my mind that Chamberlain was the more extraordinary physical presence. Russell, though, I still believe to this day, biased as I may be, he was the greatest team player in any sport that ever lived, that he was able to lift everybody around him. And how do you measure that? How do you say, how do you look at numbers and say, well, Chamberlain got more rebounds? Well, yes, but what Russell did in this sort of ephemeral way was in many respects more significant, more important. And I just don't think there's ever been anybody like Russell in any other sport.
Let's talk about some of the old-time beat writers whom you admired.
Yes.
Grantland Rice, Jimmy Cannon, Red Smith. Talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, I wanted in the book to write a little bit about sports writing. As you said, it suffers a certain amount of deprecation. People look down upon sports writers. I always mention that when people compliment me, they too often say, and I appreciate the compliment, but they say, Frank, that was really a good piece. It was so good it wasn't sports writing. In other words, if it's any good, it can't be sports writing. And so I wanted to say a little in defense, not hysterically in defense of sports writing, but there were some good sports writers. Red Smith, I believe to this day, is the best columnist that ever lived. I don't mean sports columnist. I mean, he wrote a more literary, sensitive column, or if it required a certain amount of humor, he was able to manage that. He was just the best columnist that ever lived.
He said, writing is easy. You just sit down at a typewriter, open your veins, and bleed.
I think...
Is that what you do?
Well, I think it was a lot easier for Red Smith than he read on. I think we all like to say that. I do a commentary for NPR once a week, and yes, somebody also said it's like sitting under a windmill. And you write the column or the commentary, and you say, whew, and you duck, and uh-oh, here comes the other flap, right, to hit you before you can catch your breath. But I think Smith was one of those terrifically natural writers. Rice, Grantland Rice was, and I'm convinced of this, though he was before my time, Rice died in the 1950s, really for the first half of the 20th century, I don't think there's ever been a figure in journalism who was as important in his area, in his discipline, as Grantland Rice. I mean, he was Mr. Sports Writer, and everybody was beneath him. I say in the book that he was sort of the only equivalent to Grantland Rice is ESPN, and that's a whole universe. He was not nearly the writer that Red Smith was. Wrote a lot of verse. What he called verse, refused to call it poetry. He was a humble man and well-loved. He wrote the one thing that will always be remembered. When the great score comes to mark against your name, he writes not whether you won or lost, but how you played the game. Of course...
Vince Lombardi would disagree with that.
I was going to say that Grantland Rice had not even heard of trash talking.
Right.
But he was a dominant figure and important. Jimmy Cannon, you also mentioned, and I would put him after Smith.
But he was famous for zingers, wasn't he?
Zingers.
Boxing is the red light district of sport.
Yes, all that. And his famous line was Joe Louis, a tribute to his race, the human race. That was the kind of stuff that he fancied himself as sort of an athletic Ernest Hemingway. Though a very lonely, entirely different figure than Hemingway, a very lonely man, lived in a hotel, never got married, was just totally dedicated to his column, but he was a very, very good writer. There were some terrific sports writers through the years. Perhaps there were more hacks, but there were some fabulous sports writers.
And what about the bloggers? I mean, are they any competition for the sports writers of yesteryear?
I think, no, for yesteryear, no, no.
Or even for today.
I mean, bloggers go across the journalistic spectrum, and they're no different in sports than they are anywhere else. What worries me, Jim, is that who's doing the reporting? I mean, bloggers essentially are commenting on what other people have discovered. And what worries me about journalism is that if there's nobody to pay for the reporting, then even the bloggers are going to have a hard time.
Well, there's so much to talk about, but unfortunately we have to wrap up, so I have a question for you.
All right.
Will old-fashioned sports writing survive the bloggers?
Yes.
You think it will? Frank DeFord says it will.
I think it will because sports is too dramatic and too glamorous, and people like to read about it.
Frank DeFord, thank you so much for coming by.
Enjoyed it, Jim.
People do like to read about it. They like to read about you and read things you wrote. And thank you for coming by. Tune in next week for more on the digital age. Please visit our website at www.digitalage.org. For the digital age, I'm Jim Zirin. Good night and all the best.